It is just after 1:30. We're here in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We have an informal hearing scheduled for today. We have just one item on the agenda. It is item TC1, case number PU0547, PPM Energy, Inc., Rugby Wind Farm, Pierce County siting application. And it relates to an existing application, which the commission has approved, and an existing wind farm that's operating in North Dakota. The reason for the meeting today is just to discuss with Iberdrola, who operates the wind farm, a little bit about a recent malfunction safety issue that happened with the existing Rugby wind farm. And we'll leave it to the company to describe a little bit more about what happened. But just from a commission standpoint, it, I think, is an opportunity for us just to learn a little bit more about the incident, what you all have seen since then, any preliminary information you can share with us about what you think may have caused it and what the company's doing from here on out. It's really just an information sharing opportunity for us. We, as you might expect, have received a lot of questions about it. You probably have as well. Some of them you may be prepared to answer today, maybe some not, but it's really just kind of an opportunity for us to learn more about something which has interested us. A lot of folks around North Dakota and even probably have some national and international interest as well. So with that, thank you for being here on fairly short notice. We scheduled this just a few weeks ago, and we do appreciate all of you taking the time to be here. I think what we'll do is first introduce ourselves for both for the benefit of those in the room as well as those who may be listening or watching on the web. My name is Tony Clark. I'm chairman of the commission. I'll allow my fellow commissioners to introduce themselves as well, and then we'll just go around the table from there. Kevin, Brian?
Yep, Kevin Kramer. Commissioner, I want to add my expression of appreciation for so many of you being here on relatively short notice. Hopefully you've had opportunity to learn some things to share, and obviously, as Tony said, the public interest in this is quite high. And while you know, a lot of people are probably a little bit curious and interested and stressed out, we know it pales in comparison to those same emotions you've all been living with and feeling. So we appreciate both the diligence that you've given it and the attention you're giving to us today on behalf of a lot of interested parties, of course. So welcome, and look forward to a fruitful discussion.
Great. Thanks, Brian.
I'm Brian Culk, one of the other commissioners. I'm actually from Botnos, so I know the wind farm area very, very well. I've driven by it several times, and I was just actually up there the other day and got a little bird's eye view of what's going on. The only thing I would add to my fellow commissioners' comments is that, to my knowledge, this is the first time anything like this has happened to a wind farm in North Dakota. So as we go forward as a commission, kind of getting a feel for, you know, what is our jurisdiction is some of these things that we could do, that we might do. You know, we want to find out what happened, but we also have a responsibility to figure out what we should do forward. So me personally, I just really want to know what the scope of this is and then determine, you know, some of the risks and all that. But this is the first time it's happened, and kind of this is almost like trend-setting ground right now. So I look forward to the discussion.
All right. Thanks. Why don't we start with Jerry, and then if you all can identify yourselves around the table, we'll have the other people in the room do so as well.
Jerry Leon, staff.
Patrick Fawn, commission staff.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, staff.
Mark Grumman, staff.
Scott Winnegath, Iberdrola Renewables.
I'm Tim Sack with Iberdrola Renewables.
Sarah Emery, Iberdrola Renewables.
Neil DeWitts, Iberdrola Renewables.
Charles with Renewables.
Mike Tyson, Suzlon Wind Energy.
I missed the one name, right?
Joe Melcher.
Joe. Thanks, Joe.
Yep. And the mics are fairly sensitive, so you should be good, just kind of keeping it in front of you. With that, Tim, do you want to lead off, or do you have someone else?
Yep. Thank you, Commissioner Clark. I will lead off. Again, I'm Tim Sack. I'm the Managing Director of Wind Development in the Midwest for Iberdrola Renewables, so I'm responsible for their development in a 12-state region. Before I took this position, I was a lead developer in a smaller region, and was the developer of the Rugby project, and it was before you about 5-6 years ago as we were permitting this project, and it's good to be back to see you again. I wish it was for different reasons. But we're here to provide an update on what happened, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. You know, as we went around the room and folks introduced who they were, but they didn't necessarily say what their role is. Mike is with Suzlon. He's their head of engineering. Joe Melsha is our director of plant management in the Midwest region, including North Dakota. Neil is our plant manager at the Rugby Wind Project and lives and breathes that plant on a daily basis. And Sarah's our head of permitting in the Midwest. And joining me on my right is Scott Winnegith. And Scott is our director of engineering, and he is very knowledgeable on what's happened, and will kind of give you an update on what's happened. So with that, I'll turn it over to Scott.
But Tim, you didn't bring with any attorneys?
That's what I've
said. Huh? I'm waiting to see who the attorney is in the crowd. No attorneys.
No attorneys.
Well, right now, you
said it was informal, so.
Your testimony just went up right now.
All right, thanks. So, Scott, maybe what you can do is just walk us through, and, you know, for anyone who may be listening who isn't as familiar with what happened at Rugby, just talk about what happened and what you know so far. And
very good. If it pleases the commission, I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself and then read from a prepared statement and then answer any questions about this incident you may have. So I've been in the engineering and manufacturing world for nearly 35 years. 20 years of that, aerospace design, engineering, and manufacturing. And then about 15 years ago, I came over to renewable energies, where I was involved in manufacturing, engineering, and now operations. I'm a very strong advocate of wind power and renewable energy and its place in our nation's energy mix. Iberdrola Renewables became aware of a failure of the rotor assembly at our Rugby Wind Power Project, Turbine G1, during the noon hour on Monday, March 14th. For safety reasons, we immediately secured the incident site and shut down the wind farm. In conjunction with Suzlon Wind Energy Corp., the turbine manufacturer, we launched a comprehensive investigation. It should be noted, we have run our U.S. fleet of wind turbines of more than 2,760 units for more than 63 million operating hours. And in our experience and Suzlon's experience, this type of failure is a singular event. We focused our initial investigation on the attachment of the rotor assembly to the nacelle and discovered that the accident was caused by a failure of the connection between these two components. The evidence thus far suggests there was a misalignment of the connecting surfaces between the rotor hub and main shaft flange. It appears these two surfaces were not in full contact. This condition placed abnormal stresses on the connection, causing it to fail. In conjunction with the investigation, we initiated a Rugby site-wide 100% inspection protocol. In the 70 turbines inspected, out of 3,360 bolts, we discovered 7 bolts, which is about 0.2%, that were suspect and were replaced as a precaution. Upon review of the integrity checks, both Iberdrola Renewables and Suzlon agreed the site was safe to return to service. To ensure continued safety, and along with Suzlon, we are developing enhanced ongoing checks. Suzlon, who is permanently on site, will perform these additional checks in conjunction with regular maintenance activities. I'll address questions you have related to this incident at this time.
Great, thanks. You'd mentioned that you became aware of it on March 14th at noon. How did you become aware? Was it something where immediately you knew that it had happened, or was it a case where you don't know exactly when the failure happened, but
no,
sort
we
of
know exactly. So, you know, just kind of a background, all of our wind turbines throughout the U.S. are connected to a communications network and displayed on screens not only at the plant, but also at Suzlon's facility and our facility in Portland, Oregon. So at the time of the incident, power, when the hub departed the main shaft, power was disrupted to the turbine's computer, and it flagged up a turbine fault on our screens.
Was it a particularly windy day, or was there anything different about that day than any other?
No, my understanding is that the wind speeds were about 15 miles per hour at that time. So well within the normal operating parameters.
How How many of these exact turbines are in use around the world, this particular Suzlon model?
I can't speak for the number of SE88 machines that are in operation in the worldwide, but in the Iberdrola U.S. fleet, there's a total of 314.
Okay. Mike, do you have a sense for how...
Okay.
1,800 worldwide, and again, you said 300 in the... On the in
314 the in the Iberdrola fleet.
So when you have the failure, if you will, you have a failure of power, but it could be that a bird got jammed in there and the whole thing fell off. I mean, is there a range of sensors that this is bad? As
well,
opposed to just this is a fault in power?
In this particular incident, there was a disruption of power, and with the hub no longer on the cell, there was no communications between the turbine main computer and the hub's controller.
So when did you really find out that this thing fell off?
Well, when our operations center in Portland could not reset the turbine, they called the site, and the site went out to investigate.
So roughly how long does it take till somebody gets out there to see this? Where I'm going with this is that if there was an emergency response component to this, how long would that have been till somebody could have been notified?
I'll defer to Neil to help me with the site-specific conditions in play.
As soon as we were notified of the incident, a technician was dispatched to go and look at, and our emergency response plan was activated.
And they're right there in Rugby.
Grab a mic.
Yeah, let's make sure that you have a mic because we've had requests.
Yeah, if you could start that again.
Initially, we received a call to dispatch a technician to investigate why we had communication loss. At that time, when they found that the rotor had been found on the ground, emergency response plan was activated.
So give me a time hack, though. If we know roughly noon that the sensor...
Hours.
Yeah, to when you knew that something was...
From when I knew?
Yeah.
Approximately, was it 12:15 then?
Okay.
Received the call, and from that point on, that's when we started enacting the emergency response plan, which in a whole pretty much enables everyone on the site to go to a stand down. So that was enacted. This particular turbine was actually, we had to plow into it. So there was no one at the turbine, no injuries. So the emergency response plan and the specific scenario was definitely put in full production, but because there was no injuries, we just had the local police come out. We didn't have to call the ambulance, and we were able to verify that everyone was accounted for on site.
Perfect. No, that's good. There's a lot to be learned from this, I think, all the way around. Okay.
I have a question about the 7 suspect bolts then. Was there integrity testing on those specifically to see if there was reason for suspect?
So you can imagine when something like this happens, it's very outside the normal experience. And so we put in extraordinary inspection activities to validate the integrity of the remaining turbines on site. So with Suzlon's lead, they developed an inspection protocol that would actually, there's 48 bolts that hold the hub to the main shaft. And their inspection protocol removed every 8th bolt to inspect the condition of the alignment of the threaded hole and the main shaft hole. And then we did a 100% torque check on all bolts, and then a 100% integrity check, just to a belt and suspenders check, if you will.
Sure. And so what it sounds like when you say misalignment, I mean, describe that a little for me. And
yeah, so you can imagine if you're trying to put your tire on your car and you don't get the holes lined up, it's not going to go on, or you might get one or two on and not all of the others. So that's what we call a rotational alignment check. And then in this particular case, there might have been a gap between the two mating surfaces, so your tire's not fully seated on the brake drum.
And so what? What triggered then the other, I think it was 6 or 7, that you found was some sort of issue? Was it that you found bolt integrity problems on those other ones, or was it just a matter of you noticed that that the two pieces weren't flush, basically.
Yeah, so let's walk through. At the time of the incident, there's one turbine disabled, G1, and six others that are of interest to us. One of those six was a completely unrelated issue, so it had nothing to do with this particular activity, and it was getting maintenance on an unrelated issue. Let's see if I get my math right. That's five remaining. So of those five, one was thought to have suspect bolts, but that was incorrect. That was bad information back from the inspection crew, so that one was discarded, and that left, get my math right, four remaining. And the seven bolts were found on those four remaining machines.
So again, was it that the bolts themselves you noticed had signs of stress, or was it a matter of the bolts themselves still look fine, but the alignment of the hub and the nacelle were a little bit off, as you suspected then?
We do the two checks, the torque check and the integrity check, and those seven bolts did not pass both tests,
okay.
So they were removed as a precaution. But there's, upon reassembly of those bolts, we confirmed that there's no rotational misalignment. There's no misalignment from flanges seating together.
Okay, so do you know what caused the stress on those seven bolts then?
Well, the evidence so far suggests that there was a gap between the two mating surfaces, so they weren't.
Okay, so there was a gap in those.
Yeah, and we can tell that because there's a slight discoloration from corrosion that would indicate that moisture was present between the two surfaces.
Okay, so that's something that's been fixed, and we shouldn't see that problem
again.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So that misalignment puts the bolts in an abnormal puts abnormal stresses on that connection. And the evidence of those fasteners shows that they were put under undue stress.
Would these have shown up in a routine inspection of some sort eventually?
You know, that's the question that we're asking ourselves. The normal maintenance procedures are not designed to detect this sort of misalignment throughout the operation of the machine. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, our enhanced inspection checks, we look for any gaps or discontinuities between the two surfaces.
Is this something that could happen with any wind farm you operate in, or is it this issue of, you know, a little bit of a misalignment or not having those two pieces?
As you can imagine, different wind turbine
different
wind turbine models have different methods of assembling, and the Suzlon method is a little bit different from our others. And again, this event is so out of the ordinary that we're considering it as a singular event.
Do you think it's something that will become maybe a standard check throughout the wind industry, that, you know, there was this particular failure, and although it looks like a singular failure, there were a few other turbines on in this particular farm where there was at least some sense of stress on the bolts? Is it something that, you know, within Iberdrola you're going to do a system-wide check, not just North Dakota, but, you know, potentially would have impacts in the wind industry in general?
There's a few questions there. I'll answer them not necessarily in the order you asked them. So as you can imagine, as we're going through the investigation, and even at the Rugby site, we instituted extraordinary inspection methods. And while the inspection was going on, we also instituted similar inspections on the balance of our 270 turbine, the Suzlon fleet, to inspect for any discontinuities. Now, while we can't recreate the conditions at the time of assembly, we cannot rule out the probability that this misalignment occurred at assembly or during operation. And I can assure you for the near term that we will check for bolt integrity and misalignment on a much more frequent basis than our normal maintenance activities would entail.
I'm going to assume that there at least is the potential for some litigation, some civil action, and determination of liability and things. But this, just from a layman, sounds like might be a contractor issue more than a mechanical or a equipment issue. Is that?
It may be, but again, because we can't recreate the environmental conditions that were occurring at the time of assembly, and we're still investigating what the operational variables or influences might be, we can't rule out whether it was an assembly issue or an operation issue. Now, because we don't see this condition on any of our other Suzlon turbines, we haven't come to a conclusion yet on what future checks would be initiated to look for this.
I'm still trying to get a feel for you. Back to your tire analogy of it's off a little bit, and then back to the electronic sensing. It seems to me that before the tire fell off, there should have been something that the electronics would have sensed, because the way I understand this, 48 volts, I mean, there had to be decay ahead of time that should have been picked up by sensors before it goes from I'm perfectly fine till it falls off. And that would be my biggest concern, is that our sensing is not accurate enough or detailed enough, because if our first indication is it's that bad, it's when it falls off, we've got to perhaps look at something different.
Well, I understand your concern. I'll use an analogy that's in the news right now, Southwest Airlines. You might be able to say that, they should have sensors that would detect micro cracking of the fuselage skin before it happens. But as with the Southwest incident, totally unexpected in an area that had no history of compromise or issues. As with this connection, there's no history of compromise. This has not happened before. And our sensors, there are sensors to detect vibration, but on a more coarse scale than what we might see as this starts to fail. And we think that the failure was very progressive, not over a very long period of time.
So it could have happened at 10 o'clock, it started, and 2 hours later it fell apart.
This is something that the Suzlon folks are going through some very sophisticated calculations and what-if analyses to see how many bolts have to be compromised, what's the rate of failure,
exactly,
the weather conditions that were in place a week, a month, prior to this incident. So I'm not sure I would agree that we have to worry about our sensing.
Well, where I'm going with is that not so much for your project, but as we go through these wind hearings, we're always reassured by the company that they've got the biggest and best in sensing devices. If it gets spinning too fast, they can slow it down, and they can do all. They make claims of being able to have all this on-time, real-time sensing to make adjustments, and maybe that's not accurate, what they're saying. Walk me through that, maybe.
So we do, the scenarios that you just talked about. Is the wind blowing too fast? Are we making too much power? Is the rotor spinning too fast? There are dual and triple redundancies on those things, things that can get out of hand very quickly and that we need to control. And the turbines control themselves autonomously. We don't depend on someone looking at a screen saying, well, it's getting pretty windy, we might want to turn these down. This is, I equate wind turbines to two very different technologies. They're built tractor tough and heavy as heck, but they have some of the most elegant operating software of machines that are in use by man today. So again, I won't say that you would want a sense for every conceivable failure mode, but for many of the operational activities that could get out of hand quickly, we have adequate dual and triple redundancy in these sensing.
Do you have a sense the number of units that are out there that have this particular type of assemblage? I mean, not necessarily just this Suzlon model, but models that would have a similar type of assembly that might lend itself to that?
I can't speak for all wind turbine models, but our fleet consists of GE, Mitsubishi, Suzlon, of course, Vestas, and I know I'm leaving one out.
Gamesa.
And they all, as I mentioned, they all have different assembly requirements and configurations. I've not gone back to all of the individual drawings of our turbines, but this one is slightly different from the majority of our fleet.
Okay. Maybe I can ask Mike from Suzlon. We can bring a microphone around. That'd be great. Has this caused Suzlon to look at advance fleet, generally speaking, that not just necessarily with Iberdrola, but with other providers, where it's recommended that maybe go and look at this particular assembly and see if there are any concerns, or has it not reached that level yet, or are you still in the study phase? Or?
Well, as Scott was explaining, the enhanced inspections, we're actually making those part of our normal protocol, both as part of construction, new construction going on, as well as normal maintenance activities. So really that significant learning there of actually checking for the condition of the connection is our biggest takeaway. In terms of the operating fleet, on top of the 1,800 turbines of this specific model we have, Suzlon has 7,600 turbines worldwide that have been operating for upwards towards 10-plus years, and this singular case does carry through.
Any lessons learned from the emergency response? You know, anything like this, you always probably learn things on the fly the first time you actually have to enact the emergency response plan. Any lessons learned that you're going to do something a little differently, or was it a matter of really it worked as well as you might have hoped?
One thing with safety, you can always learn from anything. With our emergency response, being a relatively new site in the area, we're constantly progressing in that. So, yeah, we will have some learning opportunities from this. But overall, the emergency response was very good, especially considering we had a stand down and everything was cleared within about 15 minutes. So, and again, no injuries is very important to us. So anything we can learn from an instance like this will be put into our emergency response plan. And that's one of the reasons with our community involvement, whether it be with the fire department, police, or any local, you know, organization that has safety equipment and stuff, we work very closely with them constantly. So
where's all the stuff at now? I mean, the turbines, is it all put back together? Is it in some warehouse somewhere? Is it still sitting out there?
Most of the equipment was shipped to Pipestone, I believe, for failure analysis.
Okay. You have to probably check those out, too, to see extra stress on those.
Yeah, we have engineering groups that have been looking at those the past week for condition assessment. It is repairable. We are putting a list of parts and components together and putting a plan together right now for repairing that turbine.
How far from what was the furthest extent of impact from the base of the tower itself?
The furthest extent?
It looked like it just... from the pictures I saw, and I think most of us have seen, they just sort of fell down pretty much vertically.
Pretty much, yeah, it pretty much came directly down. From where the turbine stands, it was 76 feet out from the turbine.
Okay.
That's not very far, then.
No, it's relatively close.
What sort of damage was inflicted on the blades themselves when that fell off? Each of the three blades was...
I'm not sure. All three, I know I've seen pictures of two of them. And the tower was slightly hit by one of the blades. I think it looks like one of the blades on the way down. And we've looked at that condition of the tower. It is safe. It is secure. And it's part of our repair assessment that we're putting together.
I guess a short answer to that for the blades was because of the impact, the blades were not salvageable.
And they're fiberglass, right?
So that is correct.
Basically, once they're done, they're done.
Yep.
You know, Scott, you earlier referred to the possible weather conditions during assembly, I think is what you were referring to. Are you able to fine-tune the inspection down to that point? I mean, are all those things documented?
Well, we know that this particular part of the assembly was conducted on September 2nd of 2009, and we're going back into records to find out what the weather conditions were at the time. But you can imagine that wind and temperature and time of day are probably factors in the assembly.
Well, I would think so. One of the things that occurred to me using your Southwest Airlines illustration, which I think is a good one. I mean, another piece of that would be, of course, that fortunately in the Southwest Airlines situation, while there was a massive failure, there were no injuries or deaths. And so the good news is they get to go back and, you know, fix things that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise before it's too late. What I'm wondering is, as the entire industry watches this thing unfold with obvious interest, I mean, beyond those of us in this room, as we've noted earlier, and we have a pretty harsh climate. I mean, one of the reasons why we have such a great wind resource is that we have such a great wind resource, which means wind turbines perform very well, but they're hard to put up. And I wonder if some of those standards maybe need to be considered, like just how windy is too windy to operate those cranes and put people up. My other question is, are you able to fine-tune this research to the point of not only knowing what time and what day and what contractor, which is pretty easily, but can you even fine-tune it down to the particular people that worked on that specific turbine on that particular day?
The short answer is yes, and we've reviewed some of the preliminary documentation put forth from the construction organization, and you know, this is done under both our and Suzlon's supervision. So, yes, we can identify all of those variables, and you know, we'll start taking a look at, all right, you know, what particular variable might have had the greatest influence on this, and you know, is this something to, you know, take into consideration in future projects?
Hmm. Is there, for Mike, anybody else, I guess, is there a, you know, based on all the data that's out there of all the turbines and, the, what is it, 63 million operating hours, is there a point where, if you're going to have a problem with a turbine, it kind of happens at the 18-month period, or is it kind of when you do have disruptions that you can chart them into a certain area, they're all over the place?
Like a car where it happens, yeah, right, exactly, after it goes off warranty.
By design.
I think there's a fine science behind reliability engineering and taking a look at parts and components and their consumption rate and service, as well as life cycle of the turbine as a whole. There's no one singular answer, but it's something that there's reasons why we have technicians on the road.
When you plot all the failures, let's say, around the country, even the world, you put all those on a graph, would there be a certain time frame that would materialize that, you know, within 18 months we know if we got good turbines or bad turbines, or they're just kind of spread out across the time frame?
I think the closest parallel I can give you is that there is a 500-hour service cycle. So at the 500-hour point, they go up and do a 100% maintenance check on the turbine, and then at that point we start the clock on annual maintenance.
Okay. So a lot of the stuff, but so is 500 hours running time, I presume? Okay, so that could mean a lot of different things, too. Okay, that's interesting.
And it should be noted that, you know,
I'm glad we paid all this money, Steve. For this. We just had all this redone. They promised us it'd be better now.
You know, the turbines are designed for a certain service life in a certain wind regime, and the Suzlon turbine is well within, you know, its design is well within the conditions that we see at the Rugby site. And in our operations and cost methodology, we expect to replace components on a regular scheduled basis. You know, no one expects the components that were delivered with the turbine, most of them, to still be in service at the 20 or 25 year service life of the machine. So we have regular inspections built into our maintenance practices. We have regular replacement of components built into our maintenance. So while you would think that, you know, there might be like infant mortality, as they say in the electronics industry, you know, that's why we have warranty periods with the turbine manufacturer, so that we're not exposed to that financial risk. It's their risk. But post-warranty, we have in our models expectation of component replacement.
And we also, to add to that, we also track the availability of the equipment on an individual unit level and on a plant level. And those industry-wide are tracked to the upper 90 percentiles. The turbine, the equipment, is available and running to that high level, including service and maintenance schedules.
So, Mike, when you got the phone call, did you do the what? What happened?
Of course. It was a difficult day, so say the least.
Wow.
Are there questions from staff, either Jerry or anyone who's not at the table?
I had one. These bolts on this thing are torque checked periodically. Is that the case?
Yeah, and Mike, help me if I misstate this. So, when the wind turbine is assembled, there's obviously 100% torque check. As Mike mentioned, at the 500 hour interval, another 100% torque check. On the anniversary of its operation, once again, it goes through 100% torque check. And then every subsequent year, there is a 10%. We check 10% of the bolts. The following year, we check a different 10%. The following year, and so on.
Okay, so they would have been torque checked once after they were assembled, and one more time after the 500 hours at this point.
Correct.
And the torque check didn't bring up any problems.
Correct.
You know, it would be helpful for me if I could see a drawing of the nacelle and the hub, how they fit together with
okay.
the bolts. Is that something that could be provided?
We can provide that. I don't have that with me today.
Sure. That's all I've got at this point.
Okay.
Thanks. Anything from anyone else? Okay. Anything else from
no,
commission?
This has been very...
Yeah, this has been very interesting. I'm sure you all have learned lots of lessons from it. And from our point of view, I mean, something like this is the information sharing is important, number one, from a public interest standpoint, and that we do have a lot of folks in the affected area and in around North Dakota who are curious about it. But number two, in our siting work, it's important that we learn from this, too, so that we're asking the right questions at future hearings of different wind farms that are sited throughout the state. And then when we write the orders, that we're doing it in a way that we've learned from experiences in North Dakota, too. So this has been very helpful today for all of us. I'm sure as you learn more and as things move forward, to the degree you can share information with us, we would certainly appreciate that as well.
Tim probably recalls that this is the first wind farm that this commission never cited under our siting laws, which have changed dramatically since that time, Tim. And while it was the first one we cited under our jurisdiction, it was certainly not the first one that was built and operational, but it nonetheless has an important place in North Dakota history.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of the setbacks and the prism through which we look at wind farms was developed through that particular hearing process and the work that Tim did and others with the company at the time. So it served us well on the whole. I think our siting laws and rules and precedent that we've set are pretty good and pretty sound, and they've protected the public interest in general. So thanks for all your work over the years.
Just will you be issuing like a final investigation or something that when it's all said and done that you can just give us a copy of it?
Yes, and the timing we're looking at is in the May time frame.
Sure.
Well, that's good.
And I just want to thank you all for just like Kevin Tony said, that we were very, very forthcoming and quick giving us the information. I mean, Jerry had a phone call pretty darn quick, and it's good to get the information, and I think everybody did exactly what they were supposed to do, so I just thank you for that.
I'd like to wrap up by saying that our highest priority is to operate these plants safely. And it's easy for me to sit back in Portland and tell Neil that, yeah, we're pretty confident that we know what the probable cause is and the mitigation inspections we put in place. But I am extremely confident that we have bracketed whatever variables exist in this particular incident, and I am supremely confident that this plant will operate in a safe manner. And I'm happy to climb up a turbine with Neil at any time, just to give his team the sense of confidence that we know what we're talking about and have their safety as the highest priority.
Thank you. All right. If there is nothing else, we will close the informal hearing. And we have no other items on the agenda, so we'll close the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Neil, they're giving you a hard time back in rugby?
No, not so much.
What's going on?
Actually, he's telling the story about the welder out there.
Somebody's giving me a hard time.
Yeah. There was a rumor going around the weird.